This whole podcast is actually about bike lanes.
Yeah, that's the secret.
We got you into it.
Yeah.
Whiskey, won't you wake in? Have some fun while you're here. Do you listen? Do you hear when it's coming?
Good evening, everybody. My name is Lee Michaels, and I'm here with Patrick Callahan.
It sounds more like a formal radio show as we start to get more into these things.
It starts that way. It never ends that way.
Yeah, but we just need Johnny Weir to, again, walk behind us to actually do that.
And not Johnny Weir, but we're here with a friend and guest, Matt Meyer.
Hey, Matt. How you doing, guys? Good to see you.
He's currently our county executive, Newcastle County executive. I guess if you're listening, you know it's an episode of Battle Scars where we talk about entrepreneurship. And Patrick and I talk about our stories. Started talking about our stories of the Archer Group that we founded, which was an ad agency in Wilmington. And now we're sharing stories of other entrepreneurs and other people involved in entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
So we're very excited to have you here, Matt, and thank you for coming out.
Thanks. I'm a little nervous. Mac had an amazing story of getting down, driving down with mom Easter weekend to Cary, North Carolina to Dirt Buster. What was the guy's name?
Oh, Dirt Worshipper.
Dirt Worshipper.
82 or something.
That's amazing how he got his first investor. And then
he made his mom walk in.
That's right. Mom, you go. And then Mark Heavis going on Shark Tank and building an incredible business that's helping a lot of people. So I gotta measure up. We got to get as many hits on this one.
I'm sure you have some great stories from it.
Do what we can.
We are doing this podcast from the Route 9 Library. Library and Innovation Center, sorry. And I really was hoping for this when we were able to line up Matt. I asked if we could do it here because in starting the restaurants, we would spend many days going to the restaurant store, which is right across the street. And the restaurant store is in this whole area is one that is not the brightest part of town, mm-hmm. the shiniest part of town. But you would watch this beautiful building go up, and whenever you know, people talk about libraries and libraries being dead and libraries being old, walking through this library was really impressive and not any of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in the Brandywine 100 library. It's kind of where I learned how to read right off 202 in the stacks, and that was a very quiet place. And my image of a library when I came into this office in 2017 was of that, a quiet place. And these are really vibrant places. There's, as you know, there's a huge auditorium here, Black Box Auditorium. There's a cafe, a lot of work on computer. Meeting rooms are one of our most frequently used things. With our 3D printers here, there's a maker space. People start businesses here. There's a Lego room for kids. It can at times be a loud place. We try to make sure there are quiet places. There's a teen room. There's a center run by the Delaware Center for Autism that's sort of a touch.
Oh, the sensory room.
Sensory room, that's kind of cool. In fact, when we just opened a new library in Middletown, right in downtown Middletown. It's the old Appaquinimic Library, and we were trying to come up with a new name for it. And so at one point, the name we were going to use was the Middletown Odessa Townsend Area Library and Digital Community Commons. We decided it was too long, and that's we stuck with the Appo Library. But we wanted to make the point that libraries are very, very different places now.
And was it intentional for it to be this community of more than just a library? Was that like
I think there's a like everything I do, I give a speech to all county employees on their first day. There are about 2,300 county employees, and on their first day of work, I talk to them, and I basically say, you report to someone who reports to someone who eventually reports to me, mm-hmm. and who do I report to? I report to the people of the county, and I think the direction the libraries have taken is really dictated by the people who use it, the people of our county. I think the desire and demand for a quiet reading place started to go away with the old like Borders, Barnes and Noble. Mm. You might remember pre-Amazon days.
I know
you guys are roughly my age. Remember those days where people, you know, if you wanted a quiet reading place, you could find it. And if you wanted to get a book, they were relatively low cost. There's still that here, of course, but it became more, people want community places and they want educational community places. When we're kids, that educational community place is the school. And as we grow into adulthood, there aren't necessarily those places. So,
and learning from others. I noticed there's a lot of community space here or events that are baking or learning how to do mm-hmm. this different skill and other things. And that isn't always done by the staff. It seems like it's also done by community members as
That's
well.
That's right. People are pitching us on ideas all the time. And I say, go ahead and do it. You know, if we can attract a crowd, we're happy to do it. I also should mention that this library in particular has an innovation story. It has an entrepreneurial story that this 10 years ago, eight years ago, was a vacant lot mm-hmm. in a neighborhood that was not always well regarded. And people in the community, particularly a woman named Mae Jarman, another woman named Bibi Coker, came together and mobilized the community to demand that this library be built here and it be built in the highest quality way. The designer of it is one of the guys who designed the African American History Museum on the Smithsonian in wow. Washington. So oh, wow. it really got the highest stunning. Quality. A lot of it's the work of Tom Gordon, my predecessor. We continued it and finished it and made sure the programming that goes on here is really high quality.
Wow. That's great.
And so this innovation center, like you come from, I think it's fascinating. We were talking about this earlier, but your background is entrepreneurism. Like you started out before that, right? Like bring us into that world. Tell us your progression as to...
So I grew up in Delaware, and as a kid, I always wanted to go to Africa. I wanted to experience something completely different than here. And so I ended up in college working during a semester abroad in a place called Dandora, which is a very poor neighborhood of Nairobi. And Nairobi, Kenya, which is a country now of about, I think, 60 million people, back then more like 35, 40 million. And I'd never been to a place with such abject poverty. You're talking about people who were struggling to make the equivalent of 50 cents a day, families, and trying to feed a family. And so in that setting, I tried to help people to do what they can. A lot of people were looking for donations. Obviously, they see someone like me coming from America, didn't often go to a place like Dandora, and they want resources. And I ultimately decided what was needed to build a community, you need demand for things that they produce. So we developed this concept of there were places out in rural areas, not in cities, but in rural areas of the country where they made sandals from used tires and sold them mostly locally. But tourists who came through often liked them. So I said, wait a second, let's develop a used tire sandal and try to sell it around the world. This is like pre-e-commerce, not to date myself too much, but the idea that you could take something and build it, make it in a place like Dandora in Nairobi, Kenya, let alone sell it across Nairobi, the interest that people in Nairobi, this big city, would have in something produced in this very poor neighborhood would be, you know, extremely unlikely. But to think you could sell it all over the world, I was like a 21-year-old who thought I could do anything. So
I could do it. You didn't land on the plane or get on the plane, land there and sit back. It's like, yeah, I think this looks good. Like, let me try to have them develop this and then we can sell it elsewhere. Like, was there a time, like a story or something like that, that you ran into someone like, you know, I can actually do it? Was it a group that came together?
What happened was I was on a train to have a beach vacation. Nairobi, Mombasa is the big like beach city.
Okay.
And we were on a train, all the students studying abroad. There were maybe 25 of us. And we got, I think, first class tickets in the train. There was first class, second class, third class. It was an overnight train, old British train. And it was my second week in the country. And we were staying in Karen, which is a leafy suburb of Nairobi. And so I'd been in Africa for 2 weeks. And the Africa that I saw in Nairobi looked nothing like what I was expecting. It was very nice. We were staying on a beautiful estate, totally scenic, amazing food, like everything. Everybody spoke English. It was great. And so I started to talk to some other people, Kenyans, who were staying in first class. And I mentioned that, you know, the Western story of Africa is totally wrong. This is a really rich country. All there is wealth. And the Kenyan's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, this is what I've seen. He's like, you want to see poverty? I'm like, well, I just want to see what the country looks like. He's like, follow me. And so I walk out of first class with them. We walk into third class. And it was a maybe 8-9 hour overnight train ride. And I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. You're talking about I don't know, 120 people just packed into a train car that it just smelled, basically it smelled like raw sewage, people going to the bathroom everywhere, babies crying. It was really terrible. And people, he's like, keep in mind, people are choosing to get on this train. They're not being forced to. They're choosing to go from place to place. And I think that the cost was something like 20 cents to go on a 9-hour overnight train. And it's what people could afford. So then shortly after that, we were traveling with students outside Nairobi in a rural area. And there was a guy on the side of the road selling sandals out of used tires. And we were all wanting to buy them. And we were paying, you know, I think $10 each for these used tires. I'm like, wait a second. If these same people who would do anything to get 20 cents to take this horrific train ride, right? What if we could get them to sell 2, 3, 4 pairs of these sandals a day? That could be transformational. So that was the source of the idea.
And so you just start playing it through with the people that were there. And then when did you make... Did you know this is going to be successful when you made your first sale of those? Or?
No, so then I was still a student. I went back to college, and I was studying software development, computer programming, and I had an opportunity to go work at Oracle Computers.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to go work at Oracle Computers. It's sort of what I'd set up my whole career to do with math and computers. But I got back in my last year in college. I was kind of obsessed with how do we go back to Kenya and make sandals. My parents are like, what are you doing? Right? You have an opportunity.
Larry Ellison's right over here at Oracle.
Right, Oracle.
He's got $1 billion. Just
and so I applied to like five grant opportunities, because the only way to go is if someone gave me the money, and I got rejected pretty quickly from 4 of them. And then one of them, which is probably the most competitive, there were like 120 people applying for 2 slots. I was in the final round, and I went and I brought some samples, product samples, and these people were like giving grants to seniors
it's
in
like
college.
A modern
didn't know
Shark
what to
Tank
do with
almost.
Yeah. Kind of. But it was for a grant for like community-based projects.
Yeah.
And like, go do it. So they gave me $10,000 to go for a year to Kenya to start this project. And I did it over taking a job at Oracle that would have made me a heck of a lot more money. Yeah. It's the best decision I ever made.
And then you saw it as a business too. Like you said, I'm going to make a business out of it.
Yeah. I think I wasn't really sure, like the idea of like social entrepreneurship and sort of a community-based business wasn't really in the common discourse then. So we struggled a lot initially with, is it a business? Is it an organization? But ultimately what we did is I owned the business initially, and then we started giving out shares to workers. And then over time, the workers got all the shares and I exited.
Wow.
So, what are some of the differences between an entrepreneur there, somebody trying to start something there, and somebody's trying to start something here in the U.S.?
Well, there are a lot more similarities and differences. Okay. The first is you learn pretty quickly. I mean, and the lessons I learned in Nairobi, Kenya, when I was 22, 23 years old, are things I use every day running our county.
Huh.
You have to execute. You have to execute. Standing up, and in my business, it's pretty easy to stand up, give a speech, and then walk away and never have to execute. Yeah. But you guys know, when you start a business, if you just stand up, give a speech, or tell your staff something, and it doesn't happen, you very quickly will lose credibility with investors, employees. You might even go to jail, right? If it's fraudulent. But you got to execute. In fact, execution is what matters. Sometimes you don't even need the message. You just need, if you execute something amazing without talking about it, it still could be incredible. So that was one thing. And in a place like Kenya, in a neighborhood like Dandora, and then we moved to an even harder place called Korogocho. If you go to a place like execution is really hard. We had our first big sale. We were struggling to sell for about 9 months. Like anything, just the sandals made of used tires were perceived as sandals for the really poor there.
Okay.
And so we're trying to sell it as a more premium product, you know, trying to sell them for $5 there, which is sort of back then was more of a premium, $10 for a pair of sandals. And then we had a breakthrough where we sold them to refugee camps. There were Care International and stuff were running refugee camps in Somalia and Sudan. Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, this wasn't really the goal, right? The goal is eventually, but this enables us to feed, you know, the mouths, feed the workers, take care of the workers for a time. And we sort of did that until eventually we had some breaks with the media in Kenya. And then Zane Vergi was a Kenya television reporter who got a job at CNN, and she loved us. She'd visit our project. So next thing you know, 3 years in, we were on CNN. Wow. We had a little piece on Sunday morning.
Oh,
we were on
great.
For about 5 minutes,
yeah.
And we sold more in 48 hours than we'd sold the entire 3 years combined. Of course, I think of it because then a week later when we're going furious, like scaling up was nuts, right? We're trying to process all the orders. A guy with a gun walked in and took everything in our warehouse.
Oh, you know.
Yeah, and it was gone. So we had just, like, I basically had to take out a loan to pay, and we ended up barely breaking even on all these orders.
Oh,
all the kind of chaos stuff that I think you could deal with here, but probably less so. And we had a security firm, we had all the stuff, but it's just things can be complicated there. A little later, when things started to stabilize and be good, a lot of our workers who were not from well-resourced families all got, one of the first things they do is they buy a little bit nicer clothes. And they would commonly get stopped by police officers who assumed that they stole it. And these are Kenyan police officers stopping Kenyans.
Right.
More a class thing, sometimes an ethnic thing. And so we couldn't figure out, like, people were making money and they were afraid to spend it on anything. Because they didn't. So challenges like that are a little different.
What was it like, though, seeing that spark, seeing somebody puts that work in and then all of a sudden they've got orders and like that must have been special.
I mean, you guys know, I think that's common everywhere. When you have an idea in your head, you share it with people who jump on to that idea. And then it's just this abstract thing. And you turn it in a way, you turn it into something that actually is able to feed someone's family and then feed several people's family and then feed 100 people, clothe 100 people, provide shelter for them. There's no better, in anything I've done, there's no better feeling in the world.
Yeah, yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah, and that's true of what you guys have done as well.
Yeah. I do remember, to a small story, you and I were at an event in Wilmington, and a waitress walked by, and you and I were talking, and you stopped, and you started speaking. Was it Kenyan?
Swahili.
Swahili. Yeah. I'm like, what? Where did this come from?
You got to speak to the workers in their language.
I know, exactly. And you have to be in part of the culture and everything else like that. How did that come? Did you learn it beforehand? I know it's a little diversion, but
I took 6 weeks of classes during study abroad. It's interesting. I studied French at my great high school here for junior high and high school. I took French for 6 years.
Yeah.
And I can barely get like three sentences out. And I took Swahili for 6 weeks, but I lived there for a year.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to talk to my workers and if I wanted to understand what was going on,
I
had to speak. I also was, you know, I was 23, 24. I was going out having a good time and just learning Swahili anywhere I went.
So then you transitioned from there and then you come back to the U.S.
Yeah, I came back. I went to law school. I was a lawyer for big companies in New York. And then I did a lot of work for startups. I actually worked for a startup law firm called Potomac Law Group that was a virtual law firm. Now everybody a lot of people know what a virtual law firm is.
Right.
The law firm doesn't need an office, but this is like 2011, 2012. Actually, it was interesting. I had a seminal moment after working as a lawyer in New York. I got a job with the State Department. I was a diplomat for a year in Iraq. And during my training, there was a guy named Alex Leskaris, who later became an ambassador. And he just said something, I still remember it. In 2009, we were training to go to Iraq, and he showed us sort of the big bureaucracy that was Iraq, both the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Homeland Security was there, the Justice Department was there, the State Department was there, and just all the agents, just trying to figure out what the Americans were doing there and who was doing what was pretty confusing. And he said, just remember that you don't have to start a company to be an entrepreneur, that even in a large organization, you can take those same entrepreneurial skills and put them to work. And I've since thought a lot about that. Like, what is an entrepreneur? All you guys really are you're people that have define a problem clearly and come up with a solution to it. And then as you evolve, you know, as you iterate, you maybe redefine the problem a little bit or a lot, or redefine the solution a little bit or a lot. Often we think of it in the form of starting a company, but it doesn't necessarily, you could be, you know, working in some division at JP Morgan and you can be an entrepreneur, or you can run a county during COVID and you can be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. For those living outside of Delaware who listen to this, you've got a perception of you try things that are not the norm. And I don't mean that bad. I actually mean that good. The Hope Center, BioBot, you know, these type of things, the sewage thing during COVID that people jumped into. Does that come from those early days in entrepreneurism?
I think it's also just from having a lot of experience in the private sector. In the private sector, very often you succeed, you win, you hit the grand slam by doing something that nobody else is doing, right? And thinking not of what today's best idea is, but the best idea 5 years from now, right? Jeff Bezos had the vision that, hey, people can buy books online, and then, hey, wait, people can buy everything online, right? And now we all think that, but he thought of it before everybody, right? And he thought differently. And at the time, like, nobody's, like, I remember particularly Zappos shoes.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's going to buy their shoes online. Yeah, like, you got to go in, you got to try them on, but he was ahead of me, right? I still don't think I've ever bought a pair of shoes online. But anyway, I think in government, very often, there's a disincentive to lead. There's a disincentive to be the outlier, whereas in the private sector, there's a huge, huge financial incentive to be the outlier that's thinking ahead. So I try to lead our county government in that way. How do we look? What's the world going to be like in 5 years? What if there are all these self-driving cars, right? We spend an awful lot of time on traffic regulation and stopping development and orienting our development around traffic. Well, I'm not saying we change everything, but let's just be really prepared so that if this self-driving world that they talk about at conferences comes to fruition, or even if it doesn't, but Google Maps tells us where the traffic jams are. Right. So whereas 10 years ago, you would just go the same way all the time, whereas now Google Maps tells you, oh, avoid the traffic jam. That changes the dynamic of how we should build roads.
Right. And do you choose people around you that do the same thing? Like, so I guess that's your model, right? Like, it's entrepreneurial in decisions in government, and then you look for the people that are on your team.
Yeah, you look for people who don't just want to do things the way things have been done.
Yeah.
You also look for people who are probably similar to, we're probably competing for employees. You look for people who are mission driven,
right?
Who like really believe in, okay, we're not just here to sit on a warm seat and run county government and, you know, whatever, cut ribbons for 4 years, 8 years. We're here because there are specific ways we want to change our community and move our community forward. And if you want to do that, we'll find a place for you on our team. If you're not interested in that, it's probably not the best fit.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think that mission-driven is become more of a standard for employees. Like, they want to know the why of what they're doing. They want to feel like there's a good in it. We always felt like we wanted people to be proud to say they worked for the Archer Group. Mm-hmm. And I love it when I see an employee out somewhere with, you know, with a grain shirt on or something like that. Like, especially in decades of low unemployment, they have got their pick of their job.
Yeah.
So they want to work for maybe a greater good. I've got a friend who works for a defense company, and he was really struggling with, you know, I'm helping missiles, but he was able to have comfort with it because his missiles help shoot down other missiles.
Yeah.
And so, like, he was able to, you know, put that, that was part of his consideration, where I think my parents, or, you know, my dad was a, you know, start to finish DuPonter, and it wasn't why am I doing this? It was just, okay, I'm going to help Uncle Doopy, and, you know, whatever they need me to do, I'm going to go do that. Mm-hmm. And that was the way. And I think now a lot of people coming out have a mission as to what they do. And I think even entrepreneurs, like you said, they don't have to be out on their own being an entrepreneur to achieve that mission.
Yeah. But also Grain in particular, if I can pick on you a little bit, you do an amazing job of giving back. I think employees like to give back. Mm. And it's like almost an additional form of compensation. Everything you do for our first responders, for police officers in particular, and letting them know that they are sort of heroes in our community doing extraordinary work, that I think adds to employees feeling like, oh, this isn't just some business where we're churning out burgers to make more money for the boss.
Right.
This is actually something that means something in the community.
Yeah. Thank you. And along those lines, I think it feeds into another aspect, which is authenticity. So a lot of places say they're first responder friendly, or they're, you know, we walked into one place and they had jackets from firemen hanging on the walls. It looks like they had just gotten them at like an Applebee's, you know, clearance sale or something.
Nothing's wrong with Applebee's, just saying.
But they came into town, they put that stuff on the wall, and there's really no connection.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you hear about those bars where it started by somebody who was an ex-police person, or, you know, and we obviously didn't have that, but building that relationship is something that it takes time, and it takes being authentic and doing it when no one's looking, kind of thing. And showing that you're not just, it's not that you're providing discounts or you're giving money or something, but that you're helping. And I think that's something that entrepreneurs, as they're attracting employees, as they're looking for what to do. I know that at Archer, when we started out, we did a lot of things that didn't necessarily affect the bottom line, but helped us long run in terms of,
Yeah. And I used to always say too, like, an employee might say, why are we doing this stuff, whatever? And you say, because I've got to walk down Market Street and I'm going to stare our customers in the eyes, right? And that's who we're building the businesses off the back. And someday we'll move down to another one, but I've got to walk down the street and meet them in the eyes kind of thing. And that was important. It had to be authentic.
And I still think about we did this couch to 5K. Patrick had gotten me into running. We moved into our new offices. We made sure there were showers there. We had people from Chase that would come over and do it, run with us at lunch because they could shower right there. Yeah. And then we got all the employees $100 credit at Delaware Running Company. We had Mike Monagle come in and teach them how to do a 5K. And then we picked a 5K like 3 months out, and we all ran in that 5K.
Couch to 5K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't for PR necessarily. You know, it was cool seeing them all wearing those shirts, but it really felt right. It felt like the right thing to do. And I think it made the employees want to be there. It gave them something to bond around.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Yeah, that's good. And that's probably more critical now than ever with people working hybrid or virtually, that sense of community. I think it was on this podcast that I heard, wait a second, like people go to the office, have historically, to make their best friends, to meet their spouses, to I don't know if that's allowed anymore, but to you know, to whatever, that's what they've done traditionally. Like, what now is it, seriously, like everything we do is on an app? Like, I'm meeting my friends on TikTok or whatever, right? I'm meeting spouse on Hinge or what? Like, it shouldn't be like that. So
Has any of that bled into community planning, like in the county? Is there any different approaches?
So there's sort of, so Tulsa, Oklahoma has this program called Remote Tulsa, where they pay remote workers $10,000 to come to Tulsa and give them a suite of sort of dream stuff to attract people, earners, I think making six figures a year or something, to Tulsa. And we talked about various things like that. I'm hesitant to do anything like that, because I think I don't know how many remote workers we want. We want something that builds community, right? And I don't know how much do we want people that are just sitting in their houses all day. It's interesting, traffic patterns have changed since COVID. The rush hour is still an issue. I imagine some people might be listening to this during rush hour. I'm not saying we're not. We take rush hour seriously, and we continue to do so. So rush hour is a lot less of a problem, still a problem, a lot less of a problem, but traffic fatalities are way up. The number of I forget the term Del Dot uses, but the total number of traffic miles traveled in Delaware is up around 2018 level. So people are traveling, but they're not going out during rush hour, so they're traveling faster, and so more pedestrians, bikers are being hurt, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so it's changing it in ways you don't necessarily anticipate. But I think certainly at least some of the mental health issues we're seeing. I don't see any data on this, but I suspect a lot of it is due to the fact that there's not, like, I think there's something to be said for waking up in the morning, going to a place where there's a community of people every day, and there are fewer of us doing that.
Yeah.
All right. So, question for you. You came from the world of entrepreneurism. You would be on the outside of government saying, like, all right, how do I got to feed my family, that type of thing. And so I remember talking to Mac from Carbetize. It's like, I'd follow the governor's social schedule and just show up to every meeting that they had. The role.
Yeah, like, I know those people.
They're not called groupies. Exactly. When they're
now being on the inside, like, what do you, the broad question is, what's the role of government in building entrepreneurism? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is, you know, what's your message for entrepreneurs in not relying on government, but how should they be looking at it to help build their, you know, certainly there's facilities like this to help enable it. So let's start with the first one. Like, what's the role of government in entrepreneurism?
So I've said since I first ran in 2016 that I think governments generally, and particularly local governments, should be channeling a lot more resources towards homegrown businesses, starting and growing homegrown businesses, than attracting businesses from outside. I think there's a whole lot of evidence. Ewing and Marion Kaufman Foundation does a lot of work showing it's much more efficient government spend to spend on the people in your community.
What does that mean,
though? So like, when I get to office, they're like, okay, let's start an investment fund and start investing. I'm like, I don't know if that's what I really think we should be doing with tax dollars. And I certainly don't think politicians should be sort of picking and choosing the winner companies, right? We want private investors to do it. If county government, there's a retiring councilwoman from Newark, Lisa Dilla, that says county government does two things. We do public safety and we do dirt, right? We do land use and sewers, and we do public safety police. So within that context, there's not a whole lot of resources, you know, the tens of millions of dollars I think you need to really flesh out an entrepreneurial strategy. I like things like when I met Lee when I was working for, when I just got back from Iraq, I worked briefly for Governor Markell, sort of his entrepreneurship advisor. And one thing he had me do is sort of study what governments are doing around entrepreneurship. I think he said the country, I ended up looking at it all over the world. And I really came on to Chilicon Valley, which is in Santiago, Chile. And what they did there, and this is like 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't much of a startup culture there. And there were a few smart people in government who said, we want to invest dollars to develop this culture. And they did. They were successful. And the way they did it is they said, okay, you are starting a company anywhere in the world. Why would you ever want to come to Santiago, Chile? I don't know what the attributes of Santiago are. There are beautiful restaurants. Yeah. There's beautiful corridors. So let's get an apartment building, a condo building in beautiful restaurant community or whatever, where there's a lot of things that attract entrepreneurs, and let's run a competition and we'll have a series of investors choose who the best companies are, and you get a package of $50,000 of stuff, almost like what I was talking about with Remote Tulsa, but not to come and work remotely, but to come and build your company here. And so I think that's ultimately what government should be doing. We haven't, because we don't have those kind of resources in county government, we have not been able to do it. What we have done is we've gone to startup competitions around the county, like the Hen Hatch, mm-hmm. like the Swim with the Sharks, which is the Newcastle County Chamber, and a series of others. And we've given them, whatever you're giving them, if you're giving them $10,000, can we double it and make it $20,000? Can we do something to make it attractive? So we're not choosing the business. You choose what. I want nothing to do with choosing, picking the winners and losers. You guys choose which ones, and we'll try to add to the ecosystem that way. Yeah. I also think just in language, I've found that there's policy that people react to, and there's also rhetoric, and I don't mean it in a it's often used negatively, but just standing up and saying, hey, we're going to open doors for you. We're going to make sure that this is figuring out our land use process. I mean, I'm in charge of it, but figuring out our land use process in the county is not easy to do. It's that if you're a startup person who likes data analytics, who likes doing, if you're obsessed with like making the best chicken cordon bleu, right? And that's what your expertise is. You're going to have enough trouble figuring out how to register your company and figure out accounting and revenues and expenses and hiring and HR to then worry about our land use process. So how do we make sure basic government processes are seamless and easy for people that want to start a company?
Right. Just get out of the way. Remove the friction, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We opened a restaurant recently in one of the cities in the state. And I had laid out I think I sent you a picture of it, laid out on the bar. We were taking over an existing restaurant, and there were 14 permits or approvals that we needed to just basically change ownership of this restaurant from the state, from the city, from departments. And it was, I ended up calling somebody at the city saying, can you help me through this process? We've done this before, you know? And so for somebody starting up a business who doesn't know all that, if they were opening their first restaurant and they were a single individual person that doesn't come from a line of business necessarily and isn't really geared to tackle these things, it could definitely be overwhelming. So
yeah,
I definitely agree with you on government. It can be a little hard. I think you and I had a conversation a long time ago where, you know, it should be a little hard just to weed out some of the people that aren't going to succeed, but yeah. Making it as straightforward and as easy as possible, I think, benefits everybody.
Yeah, I think we gotta, as government, look. I mean, there was the MBNA, that sign above every door, think of yourself as the customer. Right. Yeah. Isn't that what it is?
Yeah.
I think in government, we almost never do that. So what I do if someone comes to me is I look at everything from county government's perspective. And then you talk to someone in Wilmington or Newark, and they look at it from the city's perspective, and then somebody else from the state's perspective, federal government, and the school districts. And then suddenly and then Delmarva and the utilities. And suddenly you're the entrepreneur, and you're getting like everybody's pointing everywhere else. And you're like, wait, like someone's gotta, like leadership is about saying, wait a second, let's look at this from the entrepreneur. I make the best chicken cordon bleu in the world. And it's beneficial to our community if I start my restaurant and make it here. I don't know anything about land use. I don't know anything about permitting. Right. I don't know stormwater regulation, right? I don't know, fire code. Like, how can we develop? And you got to protect the public, right? I'm not saying dispose of all regulation. You got to do something to make sure the public is protected and safe. How do we design our regulatory environment so that startups say, okay, this is really easy. It's straightforward.
That's great.
And then I've got to hire people. So to get them, I need some bike lanes. It's my soft pitch for more bike lanes.
Yeah, no, I'm on board. I'm on board.
Yeah.
That's I don't think I mentioned the last podcast. Maybe it was after, but we were up in Philly, and they put the bike lanes. They didn't put the cars against the sidewalk. They put the bike lane against the sidewalk, and then the street parking was between it.
Yeah.
And so it created like a nice barrier for the bikes.
Yeah, it feels a lot safer.
Yeah, yeah.
This whole podcast is actually about bike lanes.
Yeah, that's the secret.
We got you into there.
Yeah.
You mentioned two stories briefly that I don't think a lot of people know about. One was the hotel, which I think is a cool story. And then the other is the, I'll call it the poopy bot, but the sewer bot. But,
oh, yeah.
Could you tell us those stories and how they came about? And because those, are, I think, are kind of fresh ways of thinking.
So,
yeah. When we heard the hotel, it's like, so wait, what did he do?
So our annual budget in the county with property taxes, fees, sewers, is about $300 million a year. COVID hit in March of 2020, and by May, the federal government had given us $322 million of additional money to spend by December 31st of that year. So that was like 7-8 months to spend $322 million.
In a very specific way, though.
It was specific, but with a lot of discretion. It had to be to address the public health crisis. Okay. Right? What does that mean? Like for us, first thing was make sure testing is widely available, do anything we can to get vaccines out there. They ended up extending the deadline additional year. So until I think it was like December 27th of 2020, we thought the deadline was December 31st. Then we're like, this is crazy. How do you, like, we're just scrambling to, if we didn't spend the money, we'd send it back to Washington. Which I always argued was not the end of the world. Like, better to do that than to spend it superfluously. But then on like December 28th, we learned the Congress extended it for an additional year too. So we ended up having a little over a year and a half to spend it. But one thing we decided to do with part of the money is just protect the most vulnerable. There were traditionally vulnerable populations, people facing domestic violence, people in abject poverty, people who had challenges getting work and getting food, getting shelter on a daily basis, who during COVID, when everything just sort of ground to a halt, would be totally stuck. As we were going into winter, about, you know, October, November, stuff starts getting cold, and people who had nowhere to go throughout the spring, summer, fall months, it becomes more of an emergency. Traditionally, there's something called Code Purple shelters in Delaware, where once the temperature goes below a certain mark across the state, there are churches and community centers that open their doors just for emergency housing. For obvious reasons, during COVID, they were not doing that, or insofar as they were doing it, a big hall that would traditionally house have capacity of 50 might have capacity of 10 or 15. In addition, the day centers, the day places that homeless people go, libraries, cafes, something called the State Service Center, all these places were closed for COVID. So there was literally nowhere for people to go in the cold. The state had a series of hotels. We were collaborating with them in the city of Wilmington and Newark on a series of hotels. The problem was people were coming in for the hotels, then they were getting kicked out in the morning. And there was nowhere to go for the day. Traditionally, they go to some of the libraries and stuff during the day. There was nowhere for them to go. And so I put together a committee starting in like June. And I said, what are we going to do? And by September, they came back with a report that we should just, the hotel industry is in total disrepair, right? No one's traveling. We should just put them in a hotel. And there were some models for it around the country. And so we studied the models, what was going well and what wasn't going well. And we decided to make it a sort of comprehensive, all services provided, large homeless shelter. There were people obviously concerned about how are you going to sustain this thing? You buy it. And I frankly said that I didn't care that much because we could buy it. We could make sure people were okay during COVID. And once COVID was over, we could potentially sell it. I talked to a few real estate developers when I bought it, and we would have lost a few million dollars if I flipped it the next day, but which I wasn't going to do. But we could. So I knew that, okay, just financially, this is a good deal. What we found over time, so then we Bought it. We closed on it December 1st. My team came with me with a plan to get it open in about 6 to 8 weeks. And I said, that's crazy. That's like end of January, February. We bought this on the premise that people are cold and need a place to, so you have 2 weeks to get it open. So we flipped it and flipped it. It's not the right word, but we got it open. We did some construction on it to make sure there was a COVID entrance, non-COVID entrance, things like that. And we closed on it December 1st and we opened the doors December 15th.
Wow.
About 75 people stayed there that night and we got up within 4 or 5 months to about 300 people a night.
Wow.
It's so 192 room hotel. There was a documentary made about the hotel that won an Emmy Award. And to date, close to 2,000 people have stayed there, not just people you traditionally think of as homeless. We've had refugees from Ukraine that have stayed there, people whose houses have caught on fire and they just have nowhere to stay for a night or two. People displaced by Hurricane Ida have stayed there temporarily. And now we have a pretty rigorous program that's 3 to 6 months where people come in, they get mental health, substance use assistance. ChristianaCare is on site. We think we're starting to study the savings. We think, for example, ChristianaCare and many healthcare providers say, get a primary care physician. Don't go to the ER for your primary care. If you ever go to an ER, you got to wait 10, 15 hours for relatively minor stuff because there are a lot of people there who it's not an emergency. They're using it as primary care. We think simply by providing primary care services to a lot of our homeless and displaced populations, that we've reduced wait times at emergency rooms for everyone. So things like that, in addition to the fact that now over 200 families have gone through our program and are living independently, sustainably, paying their taxes, working.
Well, that's great.
It's sustainable for the long term, or is it still the...
It's based on government funding, so it's hard to say. There is, for as long as we've been alive, there's been government assistance for homeless. So it's really a question of what's the most efficient use of government funding to provide for homeless people. Right now, in part because of this flood of money during COVID, we have resources to run it through 2025. Wow. So for like 2-3 years, yeah. We're in a pretty good place. But the future, we'll see what role it takes. It's been absolutely critical to collaborate with the State Department of Health and Social Services. Faithful Friends has been critical. A lot of people have animals, and their animal health is their mental health. And as I mentioned, ChristianaCare, others, Bishop Broughton in Middletown has a church, and he also has a transportation company and getting people there and around. So we have all these partners who have been critical, both to provide services and in some cases to provide some revenue, rent out rooms and things like that.
This place was empty for how many years?
it really struggled as a hotel. Yeah. My personal view, it was sort of a sad time in county land use. It probably never should have been built, but a floodplain. And we'll see. And we're hoping it's a model. We've had people visit from 5-6 states. We've had leaders from Washington, from the national government, look at it as a model.
Yeah.
What's the name of the documentary?
Documentary is called The Pathway Home. If you just Google The Pathway Home, Newcastle County, it's on YouTube.
All right. I'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
And then what about the other project?
BioBot.
Yeah. Talk to us about that.
Because that ended up on the national news.
Rachel Maddow studied Newcastle County COVID rates. So right after COVID started, I said to my team, I don't know how we're getting out of this thing. Like, I remember at the time, I am not a germaphobe. I was not touching doorknobs. I was not, you know, we were like living in fear. We didn't know what this thing was. Right. And I just said to my senior staff of the county, I don't know how we're getting out of this thing. But I promise you, it's going to be innovation. Somebody's going to innovate. They're going to find a cure to this thing, or we're going to find out it's not what we think it is, or whatever. So the best thing that we can do is just read a lot and understand what are the new technologies out there, because the people who get out of this quicker are going to be the ones that adopt the best new technologies quicker. Now, that's fraught. That's challenging, because as you guys know, many times you end up following a new technology that's just like it's the 8-track tape, whatever, Betamax. Exactly. So you got to be smart about it, and you also have to be, and it's weird to say this in government because you have taxpayer money, but you have to have some freedom to fail, right? We're going to do stuff in the interest of saving lives that might be a waste of taxpayer money. One thing that, so we read an article, I think they were monitoring sewers in France. It was somewhere outside the country. It was like a sciences, Nature magazine or something in April, where, you know, they'd had a month or 2 months longer with COVID at that point, and they were monitored. They found that you could run the same PCR test on sewage. And that was a way of identifying where COVID was in the community. it was a pet peeve of mine from the start of COVID that just in terms of data analysis, a lot of times we were being told factually, objectively, this is where COVID spikes are. But when you looked a little bit closer, it wasn't just a spike in positivity. It was also a spike in number of tests. Mm. So if you have an area where there weren't many tests, there could be a high COVID rate, just low prevalence of testing. One way to address that sort of inefficiency in using testing data is just monitor your sewers everywhere. As Tracy Searles, my head of sewers at Newcastle County, says, everybody poops, right?
Yeah. I read that book.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody poops. And so we worked with BioBot. It was two young women who started a company in, I don't know, 2018. I think they were PhD students at MIT, started a company to monitor sewers for opioid prevalence.
Right. Oh.
And they quickly and intelligently in 2020 pivoted to COVID. And we were one of the first jurisdictions in the country to sign on with them where they were monitoring our sewers. And so the first thing they did is they went to our main substation, which is outside Wilmington. It's a catchment area of about 400,000 of the 600,000 people of Newcastle County. So it gets about 2/3 of the population. Mm-hmm. The problem is it was one point. So we could tell you whether overall, like directionally, the quantity of virus we were measuring in the sewers was going up or down, but we couldn't tell you where in the county it was going up or down. So the next thing we did is we approached them and said, can we start doing this at, I think we did 12 different substations across the county carefully placed so that you could sort of see the COVID rate in your neighborhood going up or down. So you might hear COVID rates in Delaware are high, but if you live in southern Newark, you might look at this website and say, oh, wait a second, it's actually relatively low in our area. So we started doing that. We recently, I don't know if we've signed the deal yet, but we're shortly going to announce that we're going to continuing monitoring the sewers, not only for COVID, but for nicotine, for cocaine, for a bunch of other sort of public health concerns that we're hoping helps us mount a public health response. So if you see a certain pathogen is more prevalent in certain areas of the county, we can work with school systems, public education, and also with medical facilities to address it.
So it allows you to really focus the resources and not just broadly across the county, but where the need is.
That's right.
That's pretty neat.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
So we're out of COVID largely. Knockwood.
Yeah.
What are the challenges that the county has? And we're sort of in closing, but like.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I mean, I feel like we quickly flip from a public health crisis to an economic crisis. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are struggling, inflation, gas prices. And I always think, I mean, not to sound like a broken record, and I guess I'm preaching the choir here, but you can innovate your way out of problems. We had Uncle Doopy, as you say, for decades here. Now we're not run by Uncle Doopy as much as we're, you know, there's a lot of sort of Insights, Prelude Therapeutics, which is a spinoff of Chris Vaddi of Insight, other science companies similar with the banking industry, right? A lot of fintech companies rising. So I want to come on here and just make the plea, both to entrepreneurs here, for those coming out of the Horn Center for Entrepreneurship or Dell State, or coming out of high school with ideas, stay here in Delaware. We have a place for you here. It's an extraordinary, I think you guys are too multiple time entrepreneurs. I measure entrepreneurs not by the number of companies you started, but by the number of exits you have. and you've both shown a great deal of success here in Delaware. You don't have to leave for your company to grow and thrive, and you'll find a really nurturing environment here. And if we do that, you'll find that a lot of the economic indicators that people are struggling with, a lot of the struggles that families are facing will decrease over time if we can create really high quality jobs right here.
That's it's great. Interesting how we started our business right at the end of a recession, right? It was 2001 or the dot-com bubble.
Yeah.
And I do think it, like the most companies are coming out of COVID or out of these downturns. This is the best time to start a company.
I think Apple was started during a recession.
Yeah.
And I'm sure somebody's going to say Archer was started during a recession. It definitely, it makes you approach problems creatively. And it sounds like we've all been doing that.
So I have one more question. Talk about vision. Like, if you waved a wand 100 years from now, and this is from an entrepreneur's perspective, what's great about this area that made it? You know, draw me a picture of what it looks like from a government working closely with entrepreneurs. Is it focused on one area, or is it?
I think so. I was a diplomat in Iraq, as I mentioned. I spent quite a bit of time in Dubai. Dubai and much of the Gulf area of the world is very rich in natural resources. Dubai and United Arab Emirates by far is the wealthiest of that area per capita. And the way they became wealthy is by diversifying, by taking their one sort of wealth point, which is, I believe, natural gas, and leveraging it, particularly into financial services, then into tourism, then into sort of cutting edge architecture and arts. And I think similarly, we've had this generational advantage, multi-generational advantage, particularly in chemicals and chemistry, right? How do we leverage that to invest in other areas, to have like top restaurants, right? To have top arts, phenomenal arts. Maybe it's to have bike paths that run up and down our state, east and west, so everyone can kind of like, you know, Amsterdam, everybody can get around by bike. I think that's the ultimate, that we look back 100 years from now and say, wow, they took this small advantage they had in this one industry, and they were able to leverage it to innovate in all these different industries and really become a global leader.
Wow.
That's great.
I think it's a perfect time to close.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time tonight. It was great being here at the Library and Innovation Center on Route 9. And I highly recommend that people come by and check it out. It's more than just books.
Yeah. And thanks for being a good friend for the entrepreneurs. I know you've definitely been fighting for them, so it's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as they,
yeah,
they absolutely keep fighting to create jobs, I'll be here for you.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, that's all we have. Yeah. And I'll press this big red button.
All right, thanks.
Thanks so much.